There's a detail when you're talking about the Obama fiscal plan, or the stimulus,
yeah.
And you say he chooses not to, he chooses not to do any home ownership relief.
Yeah.
And it,
that's the big what if.
I know counterfactuals.
No, but it is. You talk to any of the. I mean, there's two big what ifs with the Obama administration. Mm. The simple one is more punishment. Like, why didn't they go after some of these bankers and send somebody to jail?
Yeah.
And if they were going to fine them, which they do in the end, they fine them like larger sums than any capitalist. Bank of America paid like $130 billion or something in fines. You should check the numbers. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But it was years afterwards and had absolutely zero political. You gain nothing from doing it, right? Mm. I mean, the settlement is far larger than for big tobacco, for instance.
Yeah.
And you can build entire political empires on big tobacco. That case, you know, the states that sued got these huge settlements, and they use it as a piggy bank forever after. Zero benefit from the mortgage settlements because they're far too late, and no one goes to jail. And the Obama administration positions itself defensively in front of the bankers.
Yeah,
that's the number one. And you talk to, like, I had the chance to talk to John Podesta, Obama's chief of staff, and he just flat out said, not enough punishment.
Right.
Should have been more vengeance. This was a broken contract situation, and a broken contract situation, because their worry was, if you did vengeance, there'd be even more damaging economic effects. The banks would recover more slowly, and everyone now, I think, admits that in a broken contract situation, people have been wronged and they're hurt. That is the general American population. They'll actually pay a little bit more too, so as to see the perpetrator really suffer.
Yeah.
And so it would have been good politics. Yeah. The other big question mark is, could something more direct have been done for American homeowners? Mm. And you say it's a counterfactual. It was, in fact, so, you know, the strong critique is they didn't think hard about it. They never even considered it. All they ever did. That's not true. I mean, if you take any of the senior Obama insiders seriously, they will tell you they thought about this. Larry Summers said they had a regular monthly meeting convened to gain every single option, because they could see that this was what they, you know, why can't we work this the other way around? Mm. Like, why are we bailing the banks and not the people? And I think there are like three real reasons. I mean, A, to have been effective, it would have had to have been enormous.
Yeah.
It would have been vastly unpopular, because oddly, the politics of helping one banker in the interests of the system are better for some reason than helping like a third of your neighbours.
Feckless
neighbours. And this is what the Tea Party was riding in on, right? The Tea Party is not an anti-banker mobilisation. It's an anti-welfare mobilisation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it feeds off all the toxic politics of welfare, because, of course, in the minds of your average Tea Partier, the person who borrowed the money is Latino, single mother, black, feckless white trash. Like, it's a hugely kind of anti-welfareism in America is really like Britain 70s, 80s style, welfare queen. You know, it's a really vicious kind of syndrome.
Yeah.
And that had been unleashed. And so making a $100 billion package to help the most irresponsible borrowers, and you would have to sift through to sort out the people who'd been, you know, had a little property empire, three properties and were in trouble, as opposed to the genuinely deserving. How do you even do the math on that, right? How do you do it quickly? How do you do it on a large scale? And the third element is that this would have required serious congressional political capital.
Yeah.
And the top priority of the Obama administration after the first stimulus was healthcare. And healthcare, you know, the Republicans realize this, and they just, you know, they go all in. They just make this into the Somme. It's trench warfare. Mm-hmm. They can see where the Obama priority is, and they shift priority and line up against. And, I mean, it's really hard to exaggerate how dangerous the Republicans are as a political antagonist. Yeah. They are after blood. Berner says, one-term presidency. That's his only objective. You know, in the midst of the biggest national crisis in the United States since the Great Depression or World War II, his only objective is to make this a one-term presidency.
Yeah.
And they will do anything.
So it makes more sense.
In the Obama administration, and, you know, there is a real disaster happening, and they know the midterms are going to, you know, whoop them. And, you know, that you are, it's an incredibly difficult political space to negotiate.
Yeah. Also from that part of the book, there's the G20 meeting in London, which you say is not political theatre, but it's pretty dramatic stuff nevertheless. You know, that Bretton Woods 2 thing that the Chinese were pushing, is that gone forever again now, do you think? Is that moment, because it almost...
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, one thing you could say is, in a sense, that the swap lines kill the Bretton Woods discussion.
Right.
Because the Bretton Woods discussion is really old school. Mm. You know, you imagine a bunch of governments that sit down, and their problem is to fix currencies. And then you're going to have fiscal policy that's related to that, and exchange controls, or, you know, and you're going to create a superordinate currency. And it's state to state, right? That's the anachronism of it, in a sense. And the thing about the swap lines is they're actually biting on the thing that matters in the global economy now. Money, of course, still ultimately pyramids down to state fiat money. But the reality of actual money out there in the world right now is it's created bank to bank by balance sheet operations. And so what you need is something that bites on that.
On the flows.
On the flows and on these balance sheet interactions that are created between private actors. Mm. You know, these huge tens of trillions of dollars of dollar credit, which never touched ground in the United States ever. They've got nothing to do with trade between American entities. They're simply, you know, a Swiss bank lending to a branch of Singapore that then lends to Taiwan that, you know, provides the liquidity in the system that makes smartphones. And at some point, in the end, you sell some of those to the United States, and the IP comes from Apple, but it never enters the American national economy. So the things that matter for that system of money are Basel III, so the regulation of the balance sheets of the mega banks globally, and how much balance sheet capacity they have, and whether or not the central banks at a moment of absolute crisis can provide those banks with the liquidity they need for when the proverbial hits the fan. And that's the reality of a modern Bretton Woods. The Bretton Woods of 45 is in a world where banks have been neutralized effectively. This is the world of financial repression, of boring banking. There's very little transnational extraterritorial credit creation going on in 1945. And the only place where that is still approximately true, or was true in 2008, is China. And that's the kind of China is not surprisingly the advocate, because that and their reality of their world is kind of 1950s still, right? They have exchange controls. They have direct regulation of banks, just like the Bank of England could say to Barclays in 1953, we'd like you to lend this much and not more. They do that routinely to their banks. They fine-tune fiscal and monetary policy. It's real, and they care about unemployment. I mean, it's kind of hilarious. It's just like the Keynesian set of the 50s. And fine-tuning. I mean, they seriously believe they can do this on like a, you know, as soon as they see the data, they move policy. It's instantaneous, right? All the stuff that in the 70s we decided we couldn't do that was dangerous because we had trade unions and it would cause this avalanche of gamesmanship in which the NUM would game the Bank of England over the interest rate because the NUM thought it could take the government hostage. Of course, China doesn't have that. You know, so there's no social group. I mean, what you do have is middle-class Chinese who could do capital flight if you didn't have capital controls. So you need to ensure that the elite can't just dump trillions of dollars out of their accounts to Macau or something like that. But that's the problem they're balancing, not you know, a 1970s style. Anyway, so, China, the Bretton Woods discussion, and what I find frustrating is the left bites on this, right? So Stiglitz, a lot of the kind of reformers of the late 90s and early 2000s say, right, there's a problem with the world economy, it's based on dollars, this allows feckless American behavior, so the solution here is to fix the fact that it's based on dollars. But the notion they have of it being based on dollars seems to me to be really anachronistic. Right, it's just not the world we're in at this moment.
You know, London makes the, enables the euro.
Yeah, so, you know, what a modern bank, what a modern Bretton Woods would have to be is, in fact, aggressive, progressive, leftist, macroprudential regulation of private banks. And that is really something we should be talking about. We should be really thinking about how, you know, what we think, what the left, what progressive liberals and that entire gang think about Basel III. Exactly how much, you know, like that Swiss proposal to just go to, you know, the to abolish modern banking. That's a, I mean, it would be deflationary in a savage and dangerous way. But those are the kinds of questions that we should be talking about. Like how much, and behind the scenes, the Americans did disentangle transatlantic finance, right? I mean, there are no big European banks trying to compete in the investment banking market in the United States anymore the way they were in the go-go years of the 90s and the 2000s, because they were zapped. So this is both safer, but also a competitive win for American capitalism over its European counterpart. You know, Deutsche Bank is the last one standing, and we know what condition it's in. But all the other smart European banks have exited, and they've retreated to credit card or wealth business, wealth management business, or transactions management, global commerce. They're not in that investment banking, you know, techie, derivative-driven kind of world anymore that they were in the 90s and the 2000s. And that is, I think, repeating myself, but it makes the world safer, but it also realigns the force field of global capitalism, and America emerges as the, you know, the clean winner of this moment.
Amount of dollar. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just turning to Greece then a little bit. Was the third bailout suicide or assassination?
Something else. Slow torture.
Waterboarding.
Yeah, exactly. It's more like foot binding.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, in the interests of it looking clean and tidy and manicured and conforming to some image we have of what, you know, European economies ought to look like, we're going to create this essentially crazy settlement and then impose it and maintain it and, you know, and project, like Regling and these people at the ESM who project, you know, debt stability conditions for Greece out to 2050. I mean, this is obscene. Greece's debt will become, you know, come down to the 120% of GDP mark in, you know, decades out from now.
Yeah.
I mean, this is so I think foot binding is the analogy I would use. In the sense, it's kind of formal, right? It's perverse.
Yeah.
It's torturous. It's damaging, and it's driven by a kind of formal logic that is very satisfying, very important to the culture that sits around it, right?
Yeah. Well, then the story that they've exited now.
Yeah, exactly. We're all good now, right? And they're out. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, investment is 60% down on its pre-crisis level, and GDP is, you know, tanked as hard as anyone ever tanked in the Great Depression and not recovered, not an inch of headway, right? I mean, but it's small. Like, the thing about Greece is it's tiny.
Yeah.
And, you know, the liberal in me says there's a solution to the Greek problem, and it's what the EU always ought to embrace, which is education and labour mobility.
Right.
You know, and it does require wrenching shifts in everyone's lifestyle, but as a lifetime migrant myself, I've moved continuously between countries, and it's been nothing but good.
Yeah.
And obviously, I did so from a position of enormous privilege, but my personal attitude would be that, you know, the EU ought to have a massive labour mobility programme and ought to target investment on training young Greeks to speak other languages, and they ought to move to places where there's higher employment. Because as tragic as the youth unemployment problem in Greece is, in absolute terms, it's tiny.
Yeah, yeah.
If 500,000 Greeks move, a large part of that epic and ghastly unemployment problem disappears. Now, that does mean that Greece declines. Many of its talented young people will leave. But that is in the logic of this system, and we have to own that.
Yeah.
Now, if we're going to make a go of these kind of market economics, all the way back to the 90s, the liberal progressive folks like Robert Reich and so on were saying this, right? We've got to enable various types of labour mobility. Mm. And the EU is the framework for that, but it does a very bad job, really, of enabling it.
Yeah.
And the Greek education system fails. It doesn't train enough of its young people to speak foreign languages. And I'm not saying this is like the ideal solution. The ideal solution, obviously, would be some local reflation as well.
Yeah.
But within the parameters of the system as given, that would seem to be the only way out. And it's indicative of the broader failure of Europe to really grasp the nettle of migration policy, that they can't even see this internally as the solution.
There's talk about fortress Europe to the outside.
Yeah, but it's also balkanized inside, right? It's nowhere near as easy and commonplace and culturally affirmed as it ought to be. You know, we have these images of tourism and interrail and these kind of things, but they're trivial, right?
Yeah.
What we actually need to be thinking about is a genuine kind of melting pot vision of mobility. That was implicit in the Eurozone deal. Every American economist said so. Look, if you're going to do this, you've got to figure out what happens in the US. People move. Mm. Obviously, they don't consistently move in the US either. There are still 500,000 people living in Detroit.
Mm.
Like, if you've got massive social disadvantage, racial discrimination, it's really difficult for poor people to move because they don't have the resources they need. So presumably the strategy has got to be to enable mobility, to provide mechanisms precisely for that, for which training, various types of credit assistance are crucial. And that you would have thought would be, if you were serious about this market-driven vision, that's where you would go, and you would focus all your resources on that.
Right.
And Germany would simply have to say, yes, the solution to this problem is here are the jobs for 500,000 of your young people.
Yeah.
Come.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, that isn't good politics in Germany, and they don't accommodate this with public investment. And it is let's be clear, a wrenching process of dislocation. And Greece has, of course, been through that once before in the last two generations with the emptying of the countryside to Athens. And then it would be a question of, as it were, another move from Athens and Thessaloniki to and the islands to other parts of Europe. But I don't see, if we're going to stick with the logic of this system, I don't see any alternative to that.